John 7, the seventh talk in a series entitled The Gospel of John, was presented by Ron Julian on August 3, 2008 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2008. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're continuing in our study in the Gospel of John. Last week we were in chapter 6. In that section, the famous Bread of Life section, Jesus was in Galilee, which is up in the north, away from Judea and Jerusalem and the center of things. While he was there, there was a huge crowd following him around because of the miracles he was doing. They're very interested in this guy who could heal people and feed 5,000 people from a couple loaves of bread and so forth. But he disappointed them ultimately. He wasn't what they were looking for. He didn't continue to provide that bread. He started to say weird stuff about how they needed to believe in him and his body was true food and all of that kind of stuff. And this wasn't what they were looking for, and they took off. So most of the crowd left. As we start chapter 7, Jesus is still in Galilee, up in the north. In this chapter, we're going to see him return to Jerusalem. And as we have been seeing throughout John, I mean, it shouldn't surprise us that once again, the theme we're going to be exploring is the response that people have to Jesus, the various sorts of responses that they have and why they have those responses. So the issue of believing in Jesus or not believing in Jesus, again, is going to be central, because I'm basically arguing that that's central throughout the whole gospel. So we're in chapter 8, starting in verse 1. After this, Jesus stayed in the area of Galilee, purposely keeping away from Judea, because the Jews were waiting to take his life. But when the Jewish Feast of Tabernacles was near, Jesus' brothers said to him, "You ought to leave here and go to Judea, so that your disciples may see the miracles you do. No one who wants to become a public figure acts in secret. Since you are doing these things, show yourself to the world." For even his own brothers did not believe in him. Okay, so we have this situation. Jesus is being careful about what he does. The situation in Judea, which is where Jerusalem is, at the heart of Judaism at the time, that situation is volatile. There are a number of the Jewish leaders who would like to have Jesus executed. And so for the time being, Jesus is staying up north in Galilee, his home territory. Notice, by the way, I've commented on this before, but it helps us to understand how John is using the word Jews as he goes through here. He stays in Galilee because the Jews want to kill him. Well, I don't know if you're aware of this, but Jews live in Galilee. So it's not like he's staying away from Jews. It's in particular the Jewish leadership in Jerusalem that John is talking about. And most of the time when John talks about the Jews, that's what he means. In fact, we're going to see when Jesus comes into Jerusalem that there's all kinds of discussion about what the crowd is saying about him, and contrasted with what the Jews are saying about him. Well, the crowd, they're Jews too. But it's the Jewish leadership for the most part that John is focused on there. Okay, so we've got Jesus' brothers here, somewhat puzzled by him, and I think a little contemptuous. Galilee is a comparative backwater. It's not where it's happening. Jerusalem is where the action is. So, I mean, it's kind of puzzling. Jesus is doing these miracles and acting like he's a big deal, and he's got disciples coming and going. He had a big crowd, but then he lost them, you know. But he doesn't seem to be putting himself forward. I mean, what's the point of being like this great religious leader from God if you're going to hang around in a place like Galilee. You need to go where the action is. Make yourself publicly known. Declare yourself. Let everybody see what you're doing. It's a little like claiming to be a movie star but not being willing to go to Hollywood. I mean, what are you doing? This is not where it's at. You need to go where it's at. Well, here again, we see these little touches that explore this great theme that John is exploring in his gospel. Do people believe in Jesus? Given what they see, do they recognize and believe in him as the Messiah or not? And the striking thing here is this little side comment that not even his brothers were believing in him. They have seen the miracles that he's done. We know they have because they say so. I mean, it's, hey, you're doing these miracles, but you're in the wrong place. You need to go to the big time. You need to go to Jerusalem and do this stuff so that you can be seen and recognized for who you are. They really haven't understood the significance of those miracles. If they had understood what those miracles meant, they would be throwing themselves on the floor saying, pardon us for doubting you. Why don't you tell us what you think you ought to do? But they just basically see Jesus as their brother, and he kind of thinks he's a big deal, and he's making himself out to be important, and he's not even good at it. He's making himself out like he's the Messiah or something, but he's hanging around in the wrong place. So that's what they tell him. And then so Jesus comes back to them and says, Jesus therefore said to them, my time is not yet at hand, but any time is good for you. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify that what it does is evil. Go up to the feast yourselves. I do not go up to this feast because my time has not yet fully come. And having said these things to them, he stayed in Galilee. Okay, so Jesus says, my time is not yet at hand. And here's what I think he's talking about there. He's staying away from Jerusalem right now because there are people there who want to kill him. Now, as we're going to see ultimately, he does go to Jerusalem, but he does it in a quiet sort of way. He doesn't come in with a big entourage that, the Messiah is here. He kind of comes in and he does some teaching, but he's kind of in and out. You know, this is not the big reveal. But there is this time coming when he's going to do exactly what his brothers are asking him to do. That's the triumphal entry. That's the day when he gets on the donkey and rides into Jerusalem with the crowd on the roads saying, Hosanna, you know, blessed is the one who comes in the name of the Lord. There is that day when Jesus accepts the acclamation of the crowd, rides into Jerusalem as the Messiah that he is. But that time is not yet. We're not going to do that. In fact, when he does that, I think as he very well knows, that will lead to the death that he is avoiding right now. When he comes in and declares himself to be the Messiah, that will trigger the events that ultimately lead to the crucifixion. His brothers, he's saying, you guys don't have my problems, basically. You don't have to worry about this. You can go anytime you want. There's nobody in Jerusalem waiting to kill you. And that's because they don't hate you the way they hate me, which, I mean, in the mouth of the wrong sort of person, that could sound like a kind of paranoid thing to say. But Jesus is, in fact, I think, right in what he's saying. I mean, what he's saying is actually quite profound. His brothers have the wrong picture of him and what he's about. Jesus is not a celebrity who needs to get out more so that his fans can see him. He's more like a lightning rod. He attracts the hostility of the world wherever he goes. Now, why is that? Why would he say a thing like the world hates him? Well, he says it's because I testify that what it does is evil. And I want to talk about that for a few minutes, what he's getting at there. So that statement, I think, is another one of a series of statements that we have from Jesus throughout the Gospel of John that explore this very important question. What is it that is behind the way people respond to Jesus? The issue of how are you going to deal with Jesus is the question throughout this Gospel. What are you going to do with him? How are you going to respond to the testimony concerning his miracles and the testimony to what he said and all of that. And one of the themes that John is exploring is, what is it in us that leads us one way or another in how we respond to him? Jesus had said before, you may remember, that the Pharisees were looking for the approval of men, and that they weren't going to get that in following Jesus, and that's why they weren't interested in believing him. He said before that people didn't believe in him because they didn't want to come to the light. They didn't want to be exposed as the evildoers that they were. Now here Jesus is saying something similar to that. Some people hate him because he testifies that their deeds are evil. Now, I'd like to explore this for a minute. What does he have in mind when he says this, and what should we think when we see it? I think the place to start here, that what he's saying has, I think, a broad sort of application and a subtle sort of application as we think about it. But I think if we start, it's fairly clear what he has in mind. Who is it that hates him in the context that he's talking about here? They hate him so much that they are trying to kill him. It's the Jewish leadership in Jerusalem that hates him. And has he been testifying to them that their deeds are evil? Well, yeah. I mean, that's about all he has done with them. Just about in every encounter that he has had with the Jewish leadership, in one way or another, he has called them on their attitudes. The Pharisees prided themselves on being godly, law-keeping followers of God. We're the good guys. We're doing it right. We're the ones who love God and serve God and keep his commandments. But Jesus has consistently gone against that picture and said, no, that's not true. That's not the deal. He's told them that they don't really believe the scriptures that they study so much. He's told them that they're self-righteous and proud. He's told them that they love money more than God. He's told them that they love power and prestige more than God. He's told them that they're unforgiving and unloving, and in general have totally missed the point of the law that they are such champions of. Now, this is not true of all the Pharisees, but this is Jesus' response and assessment to those Pharisees who have set themselves up as his opponents, and in particular, the ones who are in a central role of leadership in Jerusalem. They think of themselves as the most obedient, godly people on earth, when in fact Jesus calls them whitewashed tombs full of dead men's bones. I mean, that's the situation. Jesus has come out against them, charging them with being the very opposite of the godly followers of God that they claim to be. In order to believe in Jesus, they would have to buy that picture. In order to say he's the Messiah, they would have to say, yeah, you're right to say that. We are the whitewashed tombs that you say we are. Since they are, in fact, unwilling to do that, they hate him. This cannot possibly be the Messiah, because the Messiah would recognize that we're doing it right. The Messiah would not come along and tell us that we're all screwed up, because, look, we are keeping the law the way it ought to be done. And as we're going to see, an even worse problem with Jesus, he's criticizing us, but look at him. He doesn't even keep the Sabbath. So, and we'll see that here in a minute. Okay, now, how does this relate to us? I mean, that's not necessarily the particular historical situation that we fall into. I do think that behind what Jesus is saying is a fundamental truth that we have to come to terms with. In one way or another, Jesus, as a prophet and teacher from God, is confronting us with the fact that we are in trouble, that there is a God and we are not on good terms with him. We have rebelled against him. We have not loved him as we should. We have not loved our neighbor as we should. And in order to come to the gospel, in order to come to the life that Jesus is offering, we have to confront that issue. Now, maybe we won't outwardly hate him if we don't buy that picture. Maybe we redefine him instead, which is a handy thing to do. I do believe in Jesus. I believe in the Jesus who told the parable about the Good Samaritan who helped the guy who was beat up on the road. That's the Jesus that I follow, the kind of guy who helps guys who are beat up on the road. He loves people. He doesn't condemn anyone. Our Jesus is our friend, and he loves me unconditionally. Isn't that a good thing? Loving, unconditional love? He loves me unconditionally. Doesn't matter to him what I think, what I believe, that stuff. He just is on my side. So that other Jesus that people talk about who judges people and calls people to repentance, that's the Jesus I hate. And then unfortunately that actually turns out to be the real Jesus, which is a problem. So what Jesus says here, I think, that is a very strong statement that applies in a lot of different ways. I can't just say, oh, there's an unbeliever. When they hear the gospel, they go, well, it's probably true, but I hate it because I just want to do evil. I mean, it's not that simple. That's not the way we work. But I think Jesus is absolutely right in what he is fundamentally describing here. This is one of the hurdles we have to get over, is you come up to the door and he says, you know, to come in, you got to admit your problem. And if you don't want to admit your problem, then you're not going to go in. Say, I'm sorry, I'm not interested in that. Is that the only issue? No. There are many other issues that Jesus confronts us with, but this is one of the key issues, and it's mentioned several times in John. Okay, so now his brothers take off. We read in 7:10. However, after his brothers had left for the feast, he went also, not publicly, but in secret. Now at the feast, the Jews were watching for him and asking, where is that man? Among the crowds, there was widespread whispering about him. Some said, he's a good man. Others replied, no, he deceives the people. But no one would say anything publicly about him for fear of the Jews. So, we see here, Jesus tells his brothers, I'm not going, you go without me. But then after they go, he goes in secret. I mean, he waits, and then he goes and kind of slips into the festival in the middle. Now, so it's not that he was not accurate in what he told his brothers. I mean, what he was not going to do was go and make this big public proclamation of himself as the Messiah in that setting, and he didn't. But he does go. Now, we start to see here some of the numerous reactions that are recorded in this chapter. There's a lot of discussion about how people are dealing with Jesus. So while they're waiting for him here, there's a lot of buzz about what's going on with him. We've already seen his brothers don't believe in him. Now we see that the crowds in Jerusalem, before he shows up, they're talking about him. Where is he? Some of them think he's okay. Some of them think he's not okay. And just, again, notice the distinction between the crowd and the Jews. The crowd was afraid to speak for fear of the Jews. But remember, the crowd is, they are Jews. So it's not the Jews they're afraid of. It is basically the Sanhedrin and those in power who they don't want to get mad at them. Okay, 7:14. Not until halfway through the feast did Jesus go up to the temple courts and begin to teach. The Jews were amazed and asked, how did this man get such learning without having studied? Jesus therefore answered them and said, my teaching is not mine, but his who sent me. If any man is willing to do his will, he will find out whether my teaching comes from God or whether I speak on my own. He who speaks on his own seeks his own glory, but he who is seeking the glory of the one who sent him, he is true, and there is no unrighteousness in him. Did not Moses give you the law, and yet none of you carries out the law? Why are you trying to kill me? The crowd answered, you are demon-possessed. Who's trying to kill you? Jesus answered them, I did one deed, and you all marvel. On this account, Moses has given you circumcision, not because it is from Moses, but from the fathers. And on the Sabbath, you circumcise a man. If a man receives circumcision on the Sabbath, that the law of Moses may not be broken, are you angry with me because I made an entire man well on the Sabbath? Do not judge according to appearance, but judge with righteous judgment." Okay. We've talked a lot in John about how Jesus' miracles were a sign that testified to Jesus being the Messiah. But that was not the only striking thing about him. That was not the only thing that people had to deal with. Another thing they had to deal with was the incredible wisdom and power of his teaching. There was nobody around that was teaching the way he was. His teaching was so powerful and knowledgeable that even his enemies are reluctantly impressed with him. Where did he get all this stuff? And this is the Jews, it says, that said this. So, and in this context, this is not just the crowd. This is, in particular, the Jewish leaders who are seeking to kill him. Nonetheless, have to admit, there's something going on here. Where did this stuff come from? So this is another part of the evidence that people had to evaluate. This is one of those themes that's running through John. The various things about Jesus that people had to deal with and think about, what am I going to do with this? Jesus teaches with great wisdom and understanding. As it says in the other Gospels, he taught as one having authority, which greatly struck people about his teaching. But what are we going to do with that? How do we respond to this fact about him? Well, what Jesus says is this: if any man is willing to do God's will, they will find out whether my teaching comes from God or whether I speak on my own. Jesus' Jewish opponents were inclined to see him as speaking on his own. That is, he's a guy, like any other guy. He's gotten these religious ideas. He's looking for a following. He's got some things that he thinks are important that he's figured out, and he's trying to convince some people to believe him in this stuff and to follow him as their leader. But obviously, his Sabbath breaking and general disrespect for the Pharisees makes it obvious that he's a bad man. I mean, they're not... Yeah, okay, so he's a teacher. He says he's from God. A lot of people say that. But, you know, the evidence doesn't suggest that it's true. Jesus is making a different claim. He's saying, my teaching is not my own. I got what I'm saying from God. I'm not just this guy who sat around and thought, well, hey, that sounds pretty good. Let's see if people will go for that. He's saying, I have got it from God himself. I am not seeking my own glory, but the glory of God, the glory of the Father. So no, I am not an evil, self-serving glory hound. I am a righteous, obedient servant of God. So, look, you guys, I recognize that you're impressed by my learning and everything, but that's not ultimately the issue. Being impressed is not the issue. What you're going to have to decide is whether I am in fact, am the teacher from God that I'm saying I am. And once again now, we find this theme that is so interesting to John in his gospel. Jesus is asking, what's going to determine whether you believe my teaching or not? Okay, you're impressed, but what's going to ultimately determine how you respond? It is your will. It is what you want that is going to determine it. That is, if you're not willing to bend yourself to the will of God, then you will decide that I am teaching on my own. If you are willing to submit to the will of God, then you will be willing to see that what I'm saying is from God himself. It all depends on what you want. So, here again, and I know I'm probably sounding like a broken record, but this is what the Gospel of John is all about. Here again, we see this theme of evidence and response. Jesus is so obviously impressive as a teacher that everyone can see it. But what do people conclude from that? What are they going to do in response to that teaching? Well, what we believe is a function of what we want, of our will. What are we willing to accept as true? And Jesus is confronting them with the question, ultimately, is whether they are willing to do what God would have them do, which, in this case, involves an awful lot of repentance from their self-righteous Phariseeism. And so now Jesus takes the challenge directly to them. What kind of people are you? I'll tell you what kind of people you are. You my Jewish opponents, are the kind of people who have received the law from Moses, and yet you don't really do what he said. You're these great champions of the law, but you haven't really, actually, in fact, embraced the law and done it. And that's what he's going to explore here a little bit. Their misunderstanding and disregard of the law can be seen in this situation, in how they're responding to Jesus. And that's what he's talking about here. Remember, in chapter 5, we saw that the last time Jesus was in Jerusalem, he healed a man on the Sabbath. And this infuriated the Jewish leaders, and at that time, they wanted to have him executed. They started to want to seek his death, because he was such a false teacher from their perspective. And they also got even further mad when he kept describing himself as the Son of the Father. So that's when Jesus left Jerusalem, leaving the leadership there, deciding they wanted to have him executed. So here he is back, and they're still mad about that thing that he had done. This is the deed that he's talking about. I did one deed, and you're all upset about it. That they're thinking about that healing the man on the Sabbath and telling him he could pick up his pallet and walk on the Sabbath when he shouldn't be working. So what Jesus is pointing to here as he's looking back at that is the irony is that their desire to defend the law by killing Jesus in fact shows how much that they are violating what the law is all about. That they really have totally misunderstood the law in their response to him in this situation. So we're talking about the Sabbath here and Jesus' breaking of the Sabbath the last time he was there in their mind. So he says, okay, yeah, Moses commanded keeping the Sabbath, but what perspective should we have on the Sabbath? Is it an absolute? Is it this, it's just this rule? And if you keep it, you're a good guy, and if you don't keep it, you're a bad guy. What perspective should we have on the relative importance of the Sabbath and how we weigh what we're going to do to be obedient to the spirit of what God has called us to? Well, Jesus points to the interesting fact that Moses, the same one who commanded the Sabbath, is the one who commanded that circumcision be done on the Sabbath. Circumcision is an act that makes the recipient eligible to be part of the covenant blessings that God promised to Israel. It may seem strange to say so, but circumcision is really an act of benefit to the person to whom it's being done. This is a good thing. This is a thing that is opening the door to the blessings of God for them. And Moses said to do this good and important thing on the Sabbath. So we ought to see in that this principle that working for the benefit of someone is of greater importance than keeping the rule of the Sabbath. In other contexts, Jesus points to other passages that would say the same thing and even points to their own practice. He said, if you had an ox that fell in a well on the Sabbath, you'd get it out. So Jesus is basically confronting them on the perverse way they're looking at the law. You guys want to kill me. You want to take my life because I healed a man on the Sabbath. You want to kill an innocent man because he shares the same understanding of the Sabbath that Moses had, that some things are more important in God's scheme of things than Sabbath keeping. So the very law that you're pointing to as your standard, you have actually perverted and misunderstood. And I think that's what Jesus means with the language, do not judge according to appearance. I mean, there's a lot of ways we could take that, but in this case, I think what he's saying is, on the surface, you know, if you just look at the situation, it seems clear to you, we got a rule, says you don't do it, and you did it. Case closed. But righteous judgment would see under the surface of this to what the real issues are involved. On a deeper level, Jesus is a teacher from God who shares the same values that Moses had and compassionately reached out to a man who had been ill for almost four decades to heal him as an expression of God's power and God's love. That's what they ought to have seen And the fact that they can't see that shows how much they have misunderstood the law that they are the champions of. So, we continue now to see some more response to all of this stuff in 725. Therefore, some of the people of Jerusalem were saying, "Isn't this the man they were trying to kill? And look, he's speaking publicly, and they are saying nothing to him. The rulers haven't concluded that this is the Christ, have they? However, we know where this man is from, but whenever the Christ may come, no one knows where he is from." Jesus therefore cried out in the temple, teaching and saying, "You both know me and know where I am from, and I have not come of myself, but he who sent me is true, whom you do not know. I know him because I am from him, and he sent me." Okay, so we see here more of the varied responses that Jesus is getting. Now people are noticing, hey, there's that guy. And they've been looking for him and say, he's here. He's teaching. He hasn't been arrested. He hasn't been executed. So what's the deal with that? Maybe the leaders have decided that maybe he really is the Messiah. Maybe that's why they haven't executed him. Because, you know, the leadership is having a difficult time exactly sorting out what to do here. They would like to have him executed, but it's not so simple. I mean, how exactly are we going to proceed with this? And they haven't figured out what to do, and people are taking that fact that they have not acted as evidence that, well, maybe he's an okay guy. But notice the crowd, as they're speculating about this group of people now, they're having a problem with that idea. As they're exploring this, maybe they think he's the Messiah. The thing is, he doesn't fit our picture of what we thought the Messiah would be. However, we know where this man is from, but whenever the Christ may come, no one knows where he is from. Okay, I'm very interested in these little clues that try to put together what is it exactly that the messianic expectation was at the time. What were they looking for? Because it actually makes a difference as to how we understand some things for ourselves as we try to understand what were they picturing, what were they wanting. I'm not exactly sure what this is getting at, but I think it's something like this. It sounds like they were expecting the Messiah to arrive mysteriously and unexpectedly. They were not expecting for their neighbor to turn out to be the Messiah. You know, like, oh, you know, I'm kind of getting to know this guy, and, oh, hey, you know, this might be the Messiah. They had this picture. You think back to Daniel, you know, the picture of the Ancient of Days, God on his throne, and this one like a son of man coming in the clouds of heaven and receiving his kingdom and so on. I think they had this idea. Basically, their picture of the way the Messiah would come, if I'm getting this, and maybe I'm off here, but I think it's kind of like our picture of the way Jesus is going to come back next time. That is, it's just going to be this event that all of a sudden, blam, there he is. So if you know where the guy's from, that would kind of suggest that that's not him, because the Messiah is just going to show up out of nowhere in the clouds and do this great thing. I think that's what they're getting at, is this is not, that couldn't be right, because we know where he's from. He's already here. He's been around for 30 years or whatever. So that can't be him. We're waiting for this mysterious, unexpected figure to come. I think that's what they're saying. And Jesus' answer is interesting. He says, okay, well, as I would understand his answer is, well, in a sense, yeah, you know me and where I'm from. Okay, we saw in other places people saying, you know, we know who his father and mother are. So, yeah, okay, you know me. I've been around. You know who I am. But in fact, I have been sent by God, and unfortunately, you don't know him. So in the deepest sense, you really don't know where I'm from at all. I mean, yeah, you think I'm from Galilee, but there is a deeper sense that where I am from is I am the one who has been sent by the Father. And you don't have that clear at all. So, in 7:30, they were seeking therefore to seize him, and no man laid his hand on him because his hour had not yet come. But many of the multitude believed in him, and they were saying, when the Christ shall come, he will not perform more signs than those which this man has, will he? The Pharisees heard the multitude muttering these things about him, and the chief priests and the Pharisees sent officers to seize him. Jesus therefore said, "For a little while longer I am with you, then I go to him who sent me. You shall seek me and shall not find me, and where I am you cannot come." The Jews therefore said to one another, "Where does this man intend to go, that we shall not find him? He is not intending to go to the dispersion among the Greeks and teach the Greeks, is he? What is this statement that he said, 'You will seek me and will not find me, and where I am you cannot come'?" Okay, so more of the response now we're seeing to Jesus. The officials, they want to seize him. They want to arrest him. But a lot of the multitude, the crowd out there, they're believing in him. And their belief is based on the miraculous signs. They're saying, would the Christ do any more than what we have seen this man doing? The Jewish rulers are very aware of what the crowds are saying. They know that this scuttlebutt is going around. Gee, I wonder how come they haven't arrested him yet. They know that people are believing in him, and you know, they're losing people to this guy as time goes on. So they decide, we've got to act. Let's send out some of the temple guard to arrest him. That's what we're going to do. We're going to arrest him. We're done with this. We're going to move now. Let's get this guy arrested. Jesus responds by showing how little he considers himself to be under their control or influenced by whatever decisions they make this way, saying, "But basically, look, I'm going to be here for a while longer, and then I'm going away." He's talking about his resurrection and ascension to the right hand of the Father, I think. I mean, that's what he means by he's going away. And implicit, I think, in what he's saying is how insignificant it really is what the Pharisees ultimately decide to do. Until it is his time, they're going to be unsuccessful. He's going to be around. And when it is his time to go, I mean, he doesn't say this explicitly, but I think it's in the background, even killing him is not really going to stop him the way they might like. He's leaving on his own terms. He's going away to some place that they can't go when it's that time. And of course, he's being cryptic so that nobody knows what he's talking about. Wait, is he going to go teach the Greeks? What's he talking about? And now notice here, the temple guard has been sent out to arrest Jesus, but he isn't arrested. He hasn't been, nobody has got him yet, which we'll see in a minute what's going on with that. So he's still free to teach, and in fact he does so in 7:37. "Now on the last day, the great day of the feast, Jesus stood and cried out, saying, 'If any man is thirsty, let him come to me and drink. He who believes in me, as the scripture said, from his innermost being shall flow rivers of living water.' But this he spoke of the Spirit, whom those who believed in him were to receive, for the Spirit was not yet given, because Jesus was not yet glorified." So Jesus stands up, this great festival occasion. Many, many Jews from all around the Mediterranean area have come to Jerusalem for this festival, and he stands up in the middle of it and makes this great appeal. And once again, he uses the imagery of water and thirst that we saw him use with the woman at the well. With the woman at the well, he used that imagery because it was appropriate. The issue was water from the well there. And some have said, and I don't disagree with this, I don't know, it doesn't say so in the text, but it is true that a part of the Feast of Tabernacle, the ceremonies that went on as a part of this, there was a pouring out of water that was a part of the ceremony. So it's quite possible that Jesus is sort of tying himself to that event, although it doesn't say so specifically. What is clearly true is that Jesus is drawing this analogy to the way water satisfies our thirst and gives us life. We need water to live, and we have this thing that's built into us. If we haven't had it, we have this thirst. We want it. It keeps us alive, and we're built to want that thing that keeps us alive. And what he's saying is, I can give you the thing that will satisfy your real thirst, that will give you the real life and satisfy you in a way that nothing else can. And the means to satisfying that thirst, then John tells us, is in fact the Spirit of God at work in you. That ultimately it is the work of the Spirit of God that is going to bring us into that life. Now, there's a topic that would be interesting to explore, and I think I'm basically not exploring it much here in this context. I didn't have the opportunity to really think through what I would say to this. There's that interesting question that we come to at a spot like this. Well, if he says the Spirit hadn't yet been given, how do we think about the difference between our situation after the day of Pentecost and the world before that time? Was the Spirit not at work in people's lives before that time? And my answer would be, no, that's not true. The Spirit of God has always been at work in the people of God. But there is something different. This really is the age of the Spirit in a number of ways. And the day of Pentecost really does represent the start of something unique. That's a big topic as to what that might be, and I'm not really prepared to go into that here. If you have questions about that, you can ask them afterwards, and I will dodge them. We're interested here now, and Jesus makes this great appeal, and I think we don't recognize, and I'm not great at communicating this, but there's something hugely dramatic about the situation, the Feast of Tabernacle, and the Messiah of Israel stands up and makes this appeal to people, this offer. You know, I can quench your thirst. Believe in me. Come to me, and I can quench your thirst. What John is interested in is telling us that he made this offer because we have a thirst that needs to be quenched as well. But what he's also really interested in is how did people respond to this? And that's what we see here now is a variety of responses to this thing that Jesus said, starting in 740. Some of the multitude, therefore, when they heard these words, were saying, "This is certainly the prophet." Others were saying, "This is the Christ." Still others were saying, "Surely the Christ is not going to come from Galilee, is he? Has not the scripture said that the Christ comes from the offspring of David and from Bethlehem, the village where David was?" So there arose a division in the multitude because of him. And some of them wanted to seize him, but no one laid hands on him. The officers therefore came to the chief priests and Pharisees, and they said to them, "Why did you not bring him?" The officers answered, "Never did a man speak the way this man speaks." The Pharisees therefore answered them, "You have not also been led astray, have you? No one of the rulers or Pharisees has believed in him, has he? But this multitude which does not know the law is accursed." Nicodemus said to them, he who came to him before, being one of them, "Our law does not judge a man unless it first hears from him and knows what he is doing, does it?" They answered and said to him, "You're not also from Galilee, are you? Search and see that no prophet arises out of Galilee." And everyone went to his home. Okay, so now we see this variety of responses to this great proclamation that the Messiah makes on the great day of the festival. Some people respond, "Hey, this must be the prophet. This is the one that Moses had said would come, that there was a prophet coming that we needed to listen to. I'll bet this is that prophet." Others are saying, "This is the Christ, the Messiah." And this represents, I think there are a variety of opinions around, is the prophet and the Messiah the same person? Or are they different people? And how do you put that together? But then others are confused. Isn't the Messiah supposed to come from Bethlehem? I mean, isn't that what we've always been taught? You know, the prophet said that Bethlehem was where this was going to happen. But Jesus isn't from Bethlehem, he's from Galilee. So they're confused. It's interesting, I think, that John just drops this in without comment. But I think it's a kind of a hint to us that John was very well aware, for example, of what the other Gospels, it said, Matthew and Luke, and indeed, I mean, was very intimately aware of all of this stuff. He doesn't comment on it, but we know that Jesus, in fact, was born in Bethlehem, that, in fact, he does fulfill that prophecy. But then he went to live in Galilee, so he's from, everybody knows him as being from Galilee, and people are saying, well, he can't be it. He's not from Bethlehem, he's from Galilee. And Galilee, people didn't look on very kindly. That's kind of the poor relations up north. But John is faithfully recording, you know, this is what the crowd was doing. They're trying to figure this out. Who is this guy? What should we think about what he's claiming here? Believe in me and your thirst will be quenched. That sounds great, but who is this guy? And now we see the end of the story with the temple guard, which is very interesting. The rulers had decided this is enough. People are wondering why we haven't arrested him, and people are believing in him. We need to do something. Let's send the cops out after him. Okay, so the cops come back, and they say to him, well, where's Jesus? We sent you to arrest Jesus. How come you don't have him? And what they say is, that guy, I've just never heard anybody speak the way that guy does. I mean, they heard this proclamation of come to me, believe in me, your thirst will be quenched. And they forget to arrest him. They said, this is great. This is really interesting what this guy's saying. So and then he slipped away, and they said, well, we didn't get him. We were too busy listening to what it was he was saying. Which again, I'm going to say this 100 million times as we're going through John, but this is the stuff that John is really interested in. What sort of effect did Jesus have on people, and how did they respond to this? Well, here's the guys who, they were charged with arresting him, and they were so struck by what he said that they didn't do it. The Pharisees are outraged. Hey, you don't see us believing in him, do you? With the implication like, we're the cool guys. If we're not believing in him, what would you make you think that you ought to be believing in him? The crowd, the rabble out there, those people don't understand things. They don't know the law the way we know the law. Don't be influenced by all those sheep out there who are being sucked into listening to this guy. We're the guys who know, and we're not listening to him. So, you know, wake up. Don't be seduced by this guy. And at this point, Nicodemus bravely speaks up. Remember Nicodemus? We had seen him earlier in John. He came to Jesus at night, possibly because he wanted to kind of be in private because he was wondering what the others would think. We don't actually know that. We see that Jesus, in speaking to Nicodemus, was quite stern with him and said, you know, basically, you don't understand what's going on. You're the teacher of Israel, but you don't really understand the important stuff here. But we can see that Nicodemus is still hanging in there with Jesus. He's still interested in what it is that he's doing. And remember that it's true as well, we will see at the end of John, that Nicodemus helps Joseph of Arimathea after the crucifixion. They take the body of Jesus and prepare it and put it in the tomb. So Nicodemus is, he's with him. He's hanging in there. He's trying to figure out what's going on with this stuff. He says, hey, you guys, before we condemn him, shouldn't we hear him out? Doesn't the law that we're following here actually tell us that that's what we ought to do, that we ought to hear him out before we condemn him? And I'm sure that he's hoping that to be a voice that would encourage the Sanhedrin to actually do that, to actually hear Jesus out, and his hope would be that Jesus could actually justify himself to them, that he would demonstrate that he really was this teacher from God, maybe even the Messiah, and the leaders would recognize him. I mean, I would fully expect that's what Nicodemus wants. He doesn't want him to be crucified. He wants him to not be crucified. He wants him to have his chance to make his case to them. But the answer of his fellow members of the Sanhedrin is not encouraging. Oh, are you from Galilee too? Which is, I mean, this is an insult to say you're from Galilee. So, you know, it's like, what's your problem, is basically they're saying. He couldn't obviously be legit. Search and see that no prophet arises from Galilee. And I might just make a side comment at this point, is it's a little bit strange, this continued refrain on why nothing, the scriptures don't say anything about the Messiah or a prophet coming from Galilee, because actually it does. If you remember, there's the famous section in Isaiah that has been memorialized for us by Handel in the Messiah, the stuff about, for unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government will rest upon his shoulders, and we'll call him Mighty God, Prince of Peace, all that famous section. That is in a section that starts out talking about how those in darkness up north in Galilee will have a great light dawn on them. So when you look at that whole section, it actually says, basically, if you put the whole thing together, that the Galilee will see the dawning light of the Messiah. So they're saying, look in the scriptures and see that Galilee, no prophet arises from Galilee. It's actually not true. I mean, unless I'm misunderstanding something, it does. So it's interesting that they won't recognize that. I almost wonder if it isn't that prejudice against Galilee and Judea. I mean, it really is seen as kind of a there's Jews up there, but just barely kind of thing. That they just kind of wouldn't, somehow they've taken that. They're quite prepared to believe that the Messiah would come from Bethlehem, but they're not prepared to believe that he would have anything to do with Galilee, maybe. I don't know. But it is interesting that everybody keeps saying, he wouldn't come from Galilee, but I think it actually says that, unless I'm missing something. So, okay. So, chapter 7 here, we see a variety of responses to Jesus, as John has been doing all along. We have the condescending disbelief of his brothers, the hostility of the rulers, the interest of the crowd, but the confusion of the crowd and some hostility of the crowd, belief by some in the crowd, and the continuing interest of Nicodemus standing up for Jesus. So there are all these responses to Jesus that we're seeing among the Jewish people who are his people, and this is a theme that John is very interested in. But he's also interested in exploring this question of what affects how people respond. Why do they respond the way they do? And we've seen two things in this section that are related to that question. First of all, when looking at the Jewish leaders and their response to Jesus, there is this question of legalism. Legalism is not used here as a word, but I think it is the correct word to use in this context. By legalism, I mean that kind of attitude that says there is a list of rules and I am a superior person because I know those rules and I keep those rules. What marks me as being better than everybody else is I have the right list and I do the things that are on the list. The Jewish leaders wanted to kill Jesus because he was a Sabbath breaker. That's one of the things on the list. You have to keep the Sabbath, and yet he's claiming to be a teacher from God, and he's breaking the Sabbath and encouraging others to break the Sabbath. That has to be fought. That's a terrible thing. That's a perversion of what God's about, they're saying. We're good guys because we keep the rules, so Jesus must be a bad guy because he doesn't. But Jesus is saying to them that they have misunderstood the spirit of the law, that their hostility to him over this issue in fact represents their own perverse understanding of the law. The Sabbath was a religious practice that was supposed to have its place in an overall life of loving God and loving your neighbor. By turning it into a rule that was an absolute that you use to demonstrate how much better you are than people who don't keep that rule, the Pharisees had distorted the intent of it. Moses had understood, Jesus is saying, that there were more important things than not working on the Sabbath, but the Pharisees didn't understand this. And so they were prepared to kill him over the fact that he wasn't keeping the rules the way they said that you have to keep the rules, those very rules that made them, that marked them out as being the good guys, the true people of God. So that was a hurdle to their believing in him. Their legalism was a hurdle to them believing in him. And this relates to the other theme that John explores in this chapter, which is, again, as he has explored over and over as we've gone along, the way that belief is related to our will, to what we want. That what I believe about life, the things that I'm willing to say, yes, that's true, and no, that's not true, those are not just things that I come to automatically. I see a piece of evidence, I believe it, and it's done. How I respond to the evidence has a great deal to do with what I want, with what I am willing to believe. And John has explored this theme several times. If you're not willing to risk losing the approval of men, then you may not be willing to believe in Jesus. If you are not willing to admit that you're an evil person that needs mercy, then you will not be willing to believe in Jesus. If you're not willing to submit your will to God's will, he told us here, you will not be willing to believe in Jesus. You have to want the right things in order for Jesus to be somebody that you want to believe in. Well, I think this is real important, and I talked about this a little bit before, but let me finish by teasing this out here a little bit. I understand the Christian life to be a process of our having our faith tested. And what I mean by that is the Christian life is this process of living my life in the world and encountering the truths that I say I believe in the gospel and actually having to decide whether they're true in real life, where the rubber meets the road. Somebody has done something to me, and I have to decide whether I'm going to forgive them. And in doing so, I have to confront this question, do I understand how much I have been forgiven by God, and so on. I mean, and there are many, many ways that the Bible describes this process, that we are tested through the things in our life. Well, I think the biblical picture is that our doctrines, our beliefs, are a part of the testing of our faith. That what I am willing to believe is a reflection of what kind of person I am. And so the call here, believe this, here is the truth and you should believe it, is a kind of test that we're undergoing. You know, am I in fact willing to believe this thing or not? And what John has been saying is that it is the one who has been given new birth in the Spirit who will ultimately have the willingness to believe the hard truths about their own sin, about their need for mercy, about God's being more important than I am, and all of those kinds of things. Well, there's an important implication to this, I think. I think that there is this balance that we have to find. If it's a test of our faith, as I'm describing, then we recognize that the process of the testing of our faith is not an automatic and immediate one. It is a messy process. That I encounter various issues as I go through life and I wrestle with them. And each of us, as we look at those places where we have wrestled with these things, I mean, I'm the first one to say that when you look at the various places where I have found myself tested by God, you look in the middle of that process and it didn't look real good. You might think, you know, it's too bad about Ron not being a believer in everything, because I'm stuck in this place where I'm trying to sort this stuff out. Well, I think it's important for us to understand that then about our beliefs. That on the one hand, our beliefs are a crucial indicator of what's going on inside. But on the other hand, I don't think it's necessarily an automatic and immediate thing that, you know, I become a believer and every single one of my beliefs immediately falls into line with what the Bible teaches. That there's all kinds of struggle in that process, I think. My concern is that the church today, and the church actually throughout time, has been very, very tempted to fall into what we might call doctrinal legalism. The idea that here's a list, here is the approved list, just like the Sabbath was on the approved list of things you had to do to demonstrate that you were okay with God. Here's the approved list of the stuff that you're supposed to believe, and if you can check off all the things on the approved list, you're in, and if you don't check off all the things on the approved list, you're out. I think that's a false kind of picture. It rightly understands that what we believe is very important. I'm never going to say, oh, it doesn't matter that that person doesn't believe that. Notice how often in John, the issue is, I mean, Jesus is saying this over and over again. You believe in me as the Messiah, you will find life. If you reject that belief, you will find judgment and condemnation. So he's saying salvation is tied to your belief as to whether I'm the Messiah or not. And yet, we can see as this works itself out that the process of working through those beliefs can be a messy one. Does Nicodemus believe that Jesus is the Messiah at this point? I don't think we know. And he may be in the process of really struggling to sort that stuff out. I think that the text suggests that we should be optimistic for Nicodemus and that ultimately he's going to land at that spot. But this is something that takes working through, I guess is what I'm saying. So, yes, on the one hand, our doctrines are very important, and we need to encourage each other to believe the truth. We need to encourage ourselves to believe the truth, to care about what's true, and we can never be cavalier about, oh, well, you believe that, and I believe this. I mean, we need to carefully think about the implications of what it is we've been called to believe. But on the other hand, we need to recognize that the process is messy. And I'm really not in a position to say, okay, I know what the status of this person is before God because I have the approved list of things they're supposed to believe, and they don't line up with it yet. That's a mistake on both sides. And unfortunately, it seems to me, as I look at the church today, that I see the church busy, you know, my favorite metaphor, falling off on one side of the horse or the other. There is kind of traditional evangelicalism today, which has really fallen into, in many places, I think, this doctrinal legalism that I'm talking about. It's rampant among Reformed Christianity, I think. And yet, on the other hand, we see as a response to that a growing movement in the church that rejects the doctrinal legalism of evangelicalism and so has thrown out doctrine sort of altogether. It just doesn't really matter much what you believe about stuff. It matters what you do. And what we have failed to recognize is that what you believe is part of what you do. I mean, the act of believing or not believing the truth is a choice that I'm making about what I'm going to do in my life. And we can't be cavalier about that. So what I'm hoping is that we can recognize this place in the middle, that we are called to proclaim the truth, and it is of central importance ultimately whether I embrace the truth or not, whether you embrace the truth or not. But at the same time, it's not such a simple picture. And it's very easy for us to think, oh, well, of course, that doctrine, if that person doesn't believe that, then obviously they're out. And we're way too prepared to do that without recognizing the complexity of what that process can be like. Okay, so I left a few minutes, as I usually do, for any questions or comments. Richard, I saw your hand go up immediately, so we'll start over here.
The Pharisees and the Sabbath, I'm wondering, is this just something they could hang their condemnation on, or is this something that had developed an importance to them?
Well, I don't know all the ins and outs of it. I do know that if you think back to the message that came to Israel from the prophets from their captivity in Babylon and so on, was, you know, remember, God basically said, you're going to stay in Babylon for the period of time of all of the Sabbaths that you didn't keep and that kind of thing, you know, where. So this party grew up in Israel that was saying, that was our mistake. we weren't keeping the rules. And they're right. I mean, but the reason they didn't keep the Sabbath was because they just blew God off. It wasn't convenient. God had said to do it, and they said, oh, we don't care what God says. You know, I'm not going to make money if I don't work on Sunday, or Saturday, excuse me. So what God was saying was their hearts were not with him because they totally ignored what he asked them to do. But the other side of the horse that you can fall off on is then thinking, okay, now we've got it right. Now we're keeping the rules, and it is the fact that we're keeping these rules that makes us the good guys. And that's the error that Phariseeism, at least part of it, fell into. I mean, we can see there were debates among the rabbis and so forth. It's not that every Pharisee fell into that problem, I don't think. But at the time of Jesus, that was kind of the central thrust of the leadership in Phariseeism, was that emphasis on the outward obedience to these rules, such that Jesus couldn't possibly be from God because he doesn't agree with us how important it is that we not violate any aspect of these little things as we're going along. That would be the most I know about it.
So, I mean, it was kind of like a touchstone that this was like, oh, if you don't follow this, then you're definitely not in the picture.
Yeah, I think so. Me over here.
Who would that bony finger point at, Deanna?
Yeah. Okay, I'm not going to point next time. I'll let you decide, Dave.
No. You're the man.
I'm the man.
I appreciate everything he said, and that the central thing here that Jesus was saying about if you thirst, come to me, and this thing about belief being complex. What I'm thinking about mainly is the idea of the will, as you're describing it, being what we want, and I think at least the way this kind of was described to me, and I read a book by Catherine Marshall and stuff at a time when I was really kind of wrestling with what I believed, and it was described as you learn or you decide that you're not going to go by your feelings in life, but by what you will. So it was kind of making this separation between emotion and a decision mm-hmm. of the mind mm-hmm. more, I think is what it was saying. Right. Which was helpful in a sense, but mm-hmm. I think this goes farther, mm-hmm. what you're saying, because the will can involve emotion. Yeah. It's like, okay, there are these people listening and understanding that the Messiah was supposed to come from Bethlehem, but here he doesn't. As far as they know, he comes from Galilee. But, okay, but Jesus has said, if you thirst, you know, come after me. So what... If I'm wanting this, there's some reason why, but maybe someone's saying, well, this is nonsensical because it couldn't be, he couldn't be the Messiah, so why are you going to leave behind your reason and do this? But, you know, there's all this stuff involved.
Yes.
And so that, if that makes sense, it kind of helps me on this. I think the thing with the will versus feeling was more what we're talking about the Christian culture. It's just easier to say, okay, I'm going to set aside my feeling and I'm going to make this decision that brings me the right doctrines and all these things now. So I'm doing this right now. But it, then life goes on and it's not that easy.
Yeah. I think there is a kernel of truth in that idea. We find ourselves in situations where our emotions, I think, are a part of the mechanism that we know the world with. I mean, it's meant to be a part of our antenna that are in dealing with the world. So, but the problem is we recognize that a lot of times our emotional reaction to things is based on fears and beliefs and things that we don't want to acknowledge. We don't believe those things to be true. We want to fight against those beliefs. We don't think they're right, but we still somewhere kind of fear that that's true. You know, so I can have an emotional reaction that is in contrast, in tension with what I actually believe. And the idea that I want to at that point speak back to my emotions, not deny them, but try to come remind myself of what I really think is true so that my emotional reactions can kind of come in line ultimately with what I fundamentally believe about things. That distinction is true, I think, and okay. But what I'm talking about with the will here is that fundamental part of me that is going to make that choice. It's my emotions and beliefs and everything, as you were saying. It's that fundamental aspect where I'm going to decide, what am I about? What is it that I want? What am I looking for? And what John keeps telling us, what Jesus taught and what John is bringing out here, really more than any of the other Gospels do. In fact, the Gospel of John is one of the best places to go to explore this theme, is that idea, the connection between belief and what I want. That to believe significantly that Jesus is the Messiah and that I can find life in him, I have to be willing to, for example, recognize that what I've got right now isn't really life, that the stuff I'm running after and thinking that I need so much is not really going to satisfy my thirst, and what he's offering will. Well, that's a willing kind of thing. I have to look at like being fabulously wealthy and say, that's not really worth so much. I can theoretically acknowledge that that might be the case, but there's a part of me that I just want that stuff. and so I'm going to have to come to terms with that. Well, I know, Jesus is saying, actually, you could have all of that stuff and it wouldn't do you any good ultimately. So that's a place where my beliefs and my desires are in this battle, and ultimately my beliefs are going to reflect what I want. So, yeah, I think in a sense they're kind of two different issues there. And if I understood what you were saying, I think there was also a hint in what you're saying, I think is right as well, that there can be something bad about that picture if we think about belief as a question of the will, as in, it seems like a bad idea to me, but I'm just going to will myself into doing it anyway so that I can get all the goodies that Jesus has promised. That's ultimately not going to get you anywhere. I mean, you're going to have to come to terms with it more fundamentally than that. I mean, ultimately, one is going to have to say, no, I'm believing in this because I really do am committing myself to the idea that this is true, and that's what I want. So that idea that I'm just going to sort of brute force my way, into believing enough to get out of hell or something like that, that I don't think you get in on those terms. You have to be a little more involved in it than that. I don't know, Dave. You're just going to have to decide.
I just have a comment. Thinking about his brothers, it seems to me that Mary and Joseph had this miraculous experience of his birth, and they raised those boys. Mm-hmm. It's so clear that it isn't a matter of the will and of choice, because if anyone would have known mm-hmm. who Jesus was, mm-hmm. that he was born in Bethlehem, mm-hmm. that there was something miraculous about his birth and when he was 12 and teaching in the temple and how wise he was. We don't have a lot of details about when he was a child, but just the things that we do have, it seems to me that it would have been really clear to them, and yet they didn't believe either. So
yeah.
It has to be
yeah.
a choice of the human heart, right. Not just yeah. evidence, I guess.
No, that's right, and I think that's why John brings it up here, that not even his brothers were believing in him. Now, yeah. And I think that's right. That's very interesting. Of course, you'll remember one of those brothers is James, who we know as the leader of the Jerusalem church after the ascension. And we hear through Paul in Corinthians that one of the people that Jesus actually went to and appeared to after the resurrection was James. So it was kind of, James had the same sort of Damascus Road experience that Paul had, that he had basically blown Jesus off until Jesus actually came to him and called him to faith. And I think having that same sort of, and I'm sure a commensurate work of the Spirit of God in his heart, that finally, oh, yeah, I get it. That's right. So, yeah, it is a very interesting story. Let's take one more, and then we're... I have a hard time bringing myself in, reining myself in time. I apologize, you guys, but I only leave so much time for questions. So.
Why does John keep using the term the Jews? Granted that, okay, there's lots of Jews that are not the Jews.
Right.
Why doesn't he just say the rulers or the leaders or the chief priest?
Yeah. Well, he does sometimes. Although you'll notice most of the time it's when others in the situation are speaking. That is, you wouldn't expect the crowd to say the Jews haven't arrested him yet. They would say the rulers haven't arrested him yet. And that's what John records. But then when John describes that same group himself, he calls them the Jews. So, yeah, that's an interesting question. I don't know the answer to that. I suspect that it has to do with his purposes at the time. This is, you know, this letter is written, you know, a number of decades later, and I think that the situation is such that the response of the Jews as the Jews to Jesus was a significant issue at that time. I've heard different things as to the way that might be the case. D.A. Carson, I've been reading some of his stuff, and he thinks that the Gospel of John is written to Hellenistic Jews, Jews who are not in Judea but out around the Mediterranean, so very, very Greek-influenced Jews, basically to evangelize them, and that the question of the response of the Judean Jews to Jesus is an interesting, an important issue for them, and so that's why he keeps exploring that. I'm not sure, but you're right. It is very noticeable that he does that, and like I say, when nobody else does that, when he's reporting what other people say, that's not what they say, but that's the way he says it. So it is striking, and I'm not sure. Okay, well, thanks.